loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address last night. He talked about Korea, about immigration, about infrastructure, about beautiful clean coal, and many other things. We're going to talk about it in our first half hour. We're joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And her latest book is Crowds and Party. And we're joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Welcome, Ted and Jody.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks.
Jody Dean, right before we went on the air, we were talking about some of the comments made by Donald Trump. This is a long, long speech, but aside from its length, and you know, hats off to anyone who could stay awake to see the whole thing. One of his sort of signature lines there was, "We have ended the war on America's energy, and we have ended the war on beautiful, clean coal." I mean, that's undoubtedly a line that would have, I don't know, just jumped out to almost any human being in the country and around the world. But Jody, you made an interesting, and not just interesting, but important reference about how beautiful and clean coal actually is. Talk about that.
So one of the things that's really frustrating about the beautiful clean coal line is that even if you believe in a fantasy world where there is such a thing as clean coal, you have to then acknowledge the fact that the mining of that coal is done by actual people, by workers in the coal mines. And this rebirth of beautiful, clean coal is written on the backs of the working class. In other words, there was a decline in coal deaths in 2016, the lowest number of coal deaths ever since mining coal had begun in the United States. And that went way back up in 2017. So Donald Trump's victory here for so-called clean coal is written on the backs of these miners.
Ted Rawl, I think that's an important point. It looks like, or Donald Trump tries to pretend that he's the great, you know, sort of champion of coal miners and coal country. And of course, coal miners and coal country has been devastated by the decline in coal as an energy source. But it's been sort of pounded by many other factors as well. And these factors go across the board for working families in America: increasing poverty, low wages, the absence of unions, the absence of job protections. I mean, that's why coal country is suffering. And of course, we have on top of that, of course, the opioid crisis. Many of the coal miners are hurt on the job. They're wounded on the job. They get prescription medicine because of their injuries. And then they become drug addicts. And this system, this healthcare system, isn't there for them. Anyway, I don't want to focus extensively on coal, but I want you to talk about it because I know in our own commentary, in your commentary, you've discussed this in the past.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I think there's something that people don't talk about or think about a lot when they talk about Republican policy and to some extent both parties' policies vis-a-vis coal, which is that energy is somewhat of a finite game. It's a closed circle, right? So the United States government is constantly engaging in foreign policies to expand oil production overseas. For example, it didn't work, but that was the idea of invading Iraq. Trump is opening up the west and east coast, except for the state of Florida, where Mar-a-Lago is, to offshore drilling. So that's going to increase oil production. The U.S. is already producing more oil than Saudi Arabia, and it also promotes natural gas. So, you know, you can't really say that you're pro-coal while encouraging all of the main competitors to coal as well. So, you know, if you're a coal miner and that's really the only job you can hope to get, the fact is that the economic forces that are going against your industry are so vast that even if you buy this argument that this industry needs to be revived, which I come from Ohio, and I remember air quality alerts in the 1970s as a kid. They probably, my lungs are probably still paying a price for when Ohio was still a big big coal producing state. I think the world's better off without it. But even if you buy this argument, it's just ridiculous. It's talking about nothing. We're a country with real problems that actually we could solve. So maybe we should do that instead.
Jody, getting back to the theme of last night's speech, I have to say I was struck by the Washington Post coverage this morning, where the first edition called the State of the Union a virtual celebration of bipartisanship. That was ridiculous. I thought it was patently ridiculous.
They got ripped for that.
They got ripped on Twitter for saying that. But what did you take away from this speech? I mean, let's look specifically at things like immigration and infrastructure, for example. What's your takeaway?
So I think maybe we should, for a second, take seriously the claims for bipartisanship. And even I don't remember if it was the Times or the Post saying that it appeared like an era of new normalcy. Well, what's this era of new normalcy? It's that of capitalism, imperialism, and white supremacy. So, in fact, the bipartisan support would be the bipartisanship of the Congress of the billionaires, who are perfectly happy with imperialism against Korea, white supremacy and intensified policing, capitalism with a tax plan that within 10 years is going to have a 60% tax increase for the middle class and an 86% tax reduction for the absolute richest part of the country. So I think that in some way that these, even though, you know, against their intuitions, this claim regarding normalcy or bipartisanship hits on the way that the U.S. government is a government for the ruling class.
You know, Ted Rall, I agree with that. And I think what the Washington Post, I mean, the rank and file readers of the Washington Post who thought they would be anti-Trump were surprised because it sounded so favorable to Trump, that headline, a bipartisan moment. And then they changed the headline. But Jody's right in a way, because the Washington Post, it wasn't an accident that they said that they want to work with Trump because they have a lot in common with Trump, even though they have been leading the so-called resistance, meaning the fake elite resistance against Trump. Anyway, your take?
Yeah, well, I just recently saw the movie about the Washington Post about the struggle, the decision about publishing the Pentagon Papers, and it kind of reminded me of that because the Washington Post has always been an exceptionally establishmentarian newspaper, as depicted in the film, and it's just you still see that. It hasn't gone away. It's not in a position to reject power, even when it's part of its branding to do so. Right? Currently, the Post is trying to sell subscriptions by convincing, and you know, behind, and they have a paywall, and they're trying to convince people that. That they're taking on the Trump administration, but they can't really take on the Trump administration and be in with the Trump administration, and they think that the corridors of power are where news comes from. So it's, you know, just another, it's a silly contradiction, and it's a brazen one. It's easy for everyone to see, but they think they're fooling us.
One of the lines, Jody, from Donald Trump last night about people who are suffering from the impact of global climate change and natural disasters, including hurricanes. Here's the words. To everyone still recovering in Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, everywhere, we are with you. We love you. And we will always pull through together, always. Today, the day after the speech, it's announced that FEMA is ending all food and water supplies to Puerto Rico. I mean, the hypocrisy and double standard and the failure to make things like this like an obvious point of attack from the corporate-owned mainstream media that pretends to be the resistance, I mean, that, to me, speaks volumes. Go ahead.
I agree. I was really struck by Trump's claim for love and support for Puerto Rico, given that 30% of Puerto Rico is still without electricity, and there's over 3% of people who don't even have drinking water. And now with FEMA cutting off water and food distributions. And what's going to happen to these people? It doesn't seem to me like the government has their backs at all. I also think that we need to really draw out the unfortunately all too predictable racism of Trump's speech, right? The way that he was demonizing immigrants, the way he treats all immigrants as somehow the same as a tiny, minuscule number of gang members, the way that he implicitly condemned Colin Kaepernick and the Take a Knee movement against police brutality. So I think that one of the things that the mainstream media is omitting, and I think they omit it not because they're ignorant, but because they actually agree, is the way that this speech that says an American dream is stealing that back from the dreamers and is actually articulating this dream of a kind of bourgeois American white supremacy.
Well, let's talk about that, because I, like you, Jody, I thought that there were a lot of code words and code phrases that were meant to be appealing to the extreme right.
Right.
For example, non-immigrants are dreamers too. You know, that was to me, that was just a racist throwaway line for his base supporters. But shouldn't the rest of the country have noticed that as well? I mean, shouldn't we be attuned to racism in this president and in his supporters?
I think we should be. And I think one of the questions is, actually, aren't the majority of people, in fact, attuned to this? I mean, this president has an approval rating of 37%. That suggests to me that over 60% of the country is not having his message of more money to the rich, and let's give them this money as we tighten police forces, strengthen borders, and engage in imperialist war. So my hope is that this will be able to do something. That's really the challenge. But I don't think it's any mystery. It's like some people like the white supremacy and the racism. They want to be conquerors of the world, which is why they started yelling, one of USA, USA towards the end, and and it's also why the Republicans are so enthusiastic about improving the nuclear arsenal, which, incidentally, we should recall, was already started under Obama. So I think that people are aware of this, and the question is channeling that energy in a way that doesn't go with the Democratic mainstream, who are just part of the problem, but in a more radical direction.
Ted Rall, if you look back at the propaganda or the agitation of the so-called alt-right, which is just a fancy new word for the fascist forces in America. They don't want to be called fascists. They don't want to be called something that everybody, knows is bad. So they call them alt-right. And the media, cooperates and uses this language. But if you look at their actual agitation for the past 30 years, past three decades, it's focused as a white supremacist movement on these things: to limit legal immigration, to eliminate chain migration, so-called, and to eliminate the lottery visa, as well as border militarization. You can go back, and people are going back and looking at all of their literature. That's what their focus is. And as a consequence, Trump's program is just that. Get rid of chain migration, the so-called ending family, which is really family migration, getting rid of the diversity lottery. And of course, just limiting immigration, both of undocumented people, but legal people, people who would come legally. In other words, making America white again. Like, not that it was ever really white, because there was an enslaved vast part of the population that was an enslaved African population. But now we have the Democrats who are probably, I think, going to buy into the same program. So if this is the program of the alt-right, of the fascist, and it's Trump's program, now we have the Democrats perhaps going along with the program. It says a lot about how political discourse and political debate has shifted dramatically to the right in the absence of any sort of authentic opposition to white supremacy, at least in the summits of political power. Go ahead, Ted.
Well, I would argue that that's the case about every policy matter that one could possibly imagine. But yes, specific to immigration, I mean, we're just thinking about You know, when the Statue of Liberty was donated by French school children in honor of the centennial back in the late 19th century, just think about how much immigration there was then. I mean, the fact is, there's a fiction now that you hear from the right and that goes unchallenged from the media and from the Democrats that states that somehow there's some sort of line that people could go back to in their home, in their countries of origin, and wait in line in, and could apply to get residency and possibly a path to citizenship in the United States. That's simply not true. In the vast majority of citizens of the world who wake up one morning and say, wow, I'd really like to go to the United States, have absolutely no way they can do that. And there is no line to get into. There is very little immigration to the U.S. The fact is that for the last 40 or 50 years, at least, you could really arguably say that legal immigration has become cut off. And the current, what's really interesting about Trump is that he got himself elected based on a flow from south to north across the Mexico-U.S. border that was something that was in the news in the 90s. But it really isn't true anymore, right? I mean, just it's the other way around now. There's more people leaving the U.S. going to Mexico because there's more work there for them than there is the other way around. So you're literally he's literally talking about a story that is just, it doesn't exist anymore. It's like he takes advantage of not only the nativism and the xenophobia of a large segment of the population, but also their massive ignorance. They literally can't even agree on the facts of what's going on. So it raises the hatred to a level of idiocy that's truly spectacular.
I want to talk for a second, Brian, about a letter written by the president of the League of United Latin American Citizens. This is a letter written 3 days ago and sent to President Trump. It starts off, "Dear Mr. President, I would like to begin by congratulating you on setting out a reasonable framework on immigration reform and border security. Four pillars, which you have outlined, border security, DACA legalization, protect the nuclear family, and elimination of the lottery and repurpose visas, are items that LULAC can support if they remain within the current framework you have proposed. I encourage you to stay engaged, etc. As this country's largest and oldest civil rights organization, LULAC firmly believes that now is the time to move the country forward on what you have proposed, and we hope this will keep the momentum of progress on its proper trajectory. Once again, Mr. President, thank you for taking the lead on this, and let us keep our focus on the task at hand." He was beaten about the face and head by his membership for writing this letter. And now I'm looking at an article on NBC News that was released about an hour ago saying, "It will be retracted, the letter I sent out." This is Roger Rocha, the president of LULAC. "This was a mistake." I'd like to start with Jody and then go to Ted. Do you think that the Democrats can work with Donald Trump on these four so-called pillars of immigration reform, or are the two sides so far apart legislatively and philosophically that immigration reform is just not going to be in the cards?
I fear that the Democrats are going to work with him, that they'll be happy to work with him, because unfortunately, I think that they share some of the jingoistic and racist suppositions that Trump does. So, I mean, what should be the case is that they would take a stand and that they would refuse the wall, that they would refuse to draw out the process on the path to citizenship for DACA recipients, but in fact protect them quickly, let them move to citizenship quickly, that they wouldn't rely on this sort of, let's say, heteropatriarchal framework of a nuclear family as the primary option. I mean, that's also a problem. And then we should notice, incidentally, the entire Trump speech was premised on a very specific model of the family. That has nothing to do with the way that people in the country live now, right? People live in same-sex relationships. They're trans people. They're very complicated structures of adults taking care of children. Many children live in single-parent households. There are lots of extended families. So this kind of a obsession with and emphasis on a myth of a patriarchal family is also a problem. So I think too many Democrats probably hold on to it, and they will agree with Trump, and that's why they're not they don't constitute any kind of resistance to his policies.
Let me switch up to another. We have about 9 minutes left. Let me switch up to another piece, which is Trump's foreign policy. Here's his words: as we rebuild America's strength and confidence at home, we are also restoring our strength and standing abroad. This must be news to everybody around the world, where the U.S. has 1,000 military bases,
right?
Spend $700 billion, really $1 trillion on military expenditures, 10 times greater than China, five times greater than China, 10 times greater than Russia. And then he goes on, around the world, we face rogue regimes, terrorist groups, and rivals like China and Russia that challenge our interests, our economy, and our values. Here again, this comes right after the National Defense Strategy was adopted, and Trump, unusually for presidents, came out and did it himself, identifying China and Russia as the principal threats to the United States. In other words, a pretext for ramping up to an even greater degree the U.S. military budget and military expenditures, and the possibility of confrontation, the expansion of NATO further east, the sending of very significant arms, heavy arms to Ukraine right on Russia's border. Ted, you know, some people, I think they were naive, thought because Trump said he wanted better relations with Russia during the campaign. Some people, even some people on the left, were all about Donald Trump, thinking, oh, he's going to represent something new. Yes, we don't agree with him on this, that, or the other thing, but he's going to renounce regime change. He's going to adopt a new foreign policy, better relations with Russia. In other words, preventing the possibility of a clash, a possible global war between the U.S. and other major powers. And thus, he should be given some kind of tacit support. Well, here we are a year later. It seems to me that if anything, Donald Trump is an extension of Hillary Clinton's extremely aggressive policy, or what would have been her aggressive policy. And it was the same policy as Obama or George W. Bush. Anyway, more continuity than change.
Well, with Donald Trump, as with all politicians, but perhaps more with him, you never know if he ever meant any of it, right? What he truly believed in his heart, and really, it doesn't really matter. But it is a fact that he has for a long time before he started running for president criticized regime change, as you mentioned, particularly the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Certainly, he wasn't against it at the time before the invasion. That's been pretty much proven. But he turned against it sooner than many, and he did seem refreshing, right? So, it's going to be a mystery that maybe some historian will figure out. I don't think Michael Wolff knows. But someday we'll find out if he just got into Washington and, just like Obama and many other people before him, discovered that they just couldn't change the nature of the militaristic structure that requires American presidents to be figureheads and preside over this constantly expanding gargantuan apparatus of mass death. But the fact is that that's exactly what he's been doing. That doesn't seem like it's going to reverse anytime soon. And coupled with dangerously nationalistic, jingoistic, saber-rattling, I was struck by the couplet where he said that he hoped that there might someday be a magical time when the world might be able to get rid of nuclear weapons, but in the meantime, he hopes he doesn't have to use them. So in the same breath, mentioning disarmament as a dream, which is great to hear, but at the same time also mentioning the nightmare that perhaps the U.S. would want to use them, perhaps preemptively. So, the madness continues. I don't think it matters. I think the Dalai Lama could be president of the United States, and he would continue to preside over the same system.
I think especially the Dalai Lama. Anyway, but that's another question. But Jody Dean, again, Donald Trump's words: as part of our defense, we must modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, as if it's like all, you know, out in the back alley, part of the garbage dump. Quote, hopefully never having to use it, but making it so strong and so powerful that it will deter any acts of aggression by any other nation or anyone else. Now, here again, the Democrats are ranting and rallying against Donald Trump on so many things. But in terms of foreign policy and in terms of the military budget, the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress actually increased U.S. military expenditures for this year above and beyond that which Trump the Trump proposal was from the White House by $40 billion. And the rebuilding our nuclear arsenal, I mean, how again can the media, any sort of self-respecting media, not go at this when, of course, the United States has the vast, biggest, most expensive, most far-flung nuclear arsenal in the world and by any time in the world? Go ahead.
Yeah. So it seems really clear. Both parties are imperialist, and the mainstream media eggs on U.S. imperialism. It egged on the march to war in Iraq. It egged on the bombing of Afghanistan. It much of the time, it eggs on the amplification of hostilities against Korea. So I think that this structure of U.S. imperialism is really deeply embedded. And like Ted said, it's not something that changes easily simply with the shift from one figurehead to another. Trump in his speech said something to the effect of unmatched power is the sure means to our defense. And I think with that point, he was articulating a view that both parties share, that somehow the U.S. has to ensure its dominance all over the world. And the thing is that history has shown that that the more U.S. dominance relies on something like nuclear weapons, in fact, the weaker we are, right? We were defeated in Vietnam. We're unable to do anything that requires diplomacy, that requires agility, that requires making friends, that requires some version of global solidarity. And in fact, it leaves us increasingly isolated. Which on the one hand should be a good thing. We should just be set in the corner and ignored, but we're too powerful. And that's what they want to hold on to. And it's utterly destabilizing in the world.
Ted Rall, we have just under 2 minutes left. I want you to make a prediction because I know you're always right. And here we have the Washington Post headline, a bipartisan blah, blah, blah speech. And again, they took it down. But it seems to me that Trump could easily make lots of deals with the Democratic Party elites in Congress and have almost, universal support within Congress if he does a few things. And then you have a situation where this person, like the way we thought of Ronald Reagan in 1981, as a maniac, I did, as a
right.
lunatic,
no,
as somebody
I did too.
Too right-wing, who then a few years later became like the darling of all things in Washington, and it's like the Ronald Reagan Revolution. Is it possible that Donald Trump, even Donald Trump, could be normalized? Go ahead, 1 minute left.
No, I don't think so. I think the elites within the Beltway have decided that Donald Trump cannot be normalized. They've given him, it's been over a year, they tried. His behavior is not going to change. I don't think his personality will allow it. So I don't think he'll be normalized. I think he'll be... they'll continue to view him as someone who they can't work with. And, that's the biggest sin, right, is the fact that he's been constantly making deals and then undermining the same deals. In Washington, a handshake deal is the most important currency, even worth more than Bitcoin. So he's proven himself too untrustworthy. Nobody can deal with him, so... No, he won't be normalized.
All right. Again, that was Ted Rall, who is always right. So we'll come back, Ted, and make sure that you're right again.
Oh, can I just add one thing on this?
20 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that Trump, the person, can't be normalized, but Trump's policies are all too normal, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think that's right. We're joined from Geneva, New York, by Jody Dean. She is a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. She's an author, a writer. Her latest book is Crowds and Party. And we've been joined from New York City by Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
The White House is saying that President Trump has not yet decided whether to release the Nunes memo, although he was overheard at the State of the Union address last night saying that he would, quote, 100% release it. Meanwhile, the plot thickens at the FBI as its inspector general is now investigating the actions of former Director James Comey and Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, their role in the Hillary Clinton emails and the FISA warrant they requested to look at and people in the Trump campaign. We are joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Welcome back, Colleen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, thank you for joining. There's many different elements and pieces of this story. And again, for like average people who may not be devoting all of their lives to following every twist and turn in the plot, we want to be able to, in this next half an hour, kind of go over the main contours of what this is, some of the main features. But let's start with the new news. What do you think is in the Nunes memos, and do you think Trump will order its release? The FBI, by the way, has just publicly said, you know, publicly in a very strong way, that this memo should not be released.
Which is, Ray is not, of course, that's not going to serve him well in terms of his position with Trump. But credit to him, if that's what he thinks.
Him meaning who in this case?
The FBI, the new FBI director, Ray, which would have had to sign off on saying that this memo is damaging to national security or whatever they claim, will not serve Ray in good stead with Trump.
Got it. Go ahead.
And so actually, I would give him credit in that sense for showing independence. I think Trump will release it. He's just, I think, probably making it seem more important than it is by delaying a little. And certainly he didn't want to release it last night to interfere with the coverage of the State of the Union. So, and of course, the other thing with releasing is you don't want to release it on a Friday afternoon when it gets little or no play over the weekend. So either he has to release it probably tomorrow, at the latest. If he doesn't release it tomorrow, then it would have to probably be the next week. I think it will be released. From everything I've read about it, what Lindsey Graham was almost the first person to describe what is in the memo. He described it quite a while ago. And since that time, Trey Gowdy and others have all been talking about it. That's a reason to question why the FBI's position that it's going to hurt national security, when they've already really described what's in the memo already. It probably shouldn't be that exciting for most people because we already know what's in it. I think the bulk of it, from what I've read and what people have said, is that it's the seeking of the FISA warrant in the late summer or fall, maybe sometime in that, on Carter Page, maybe others in the Trump campaign, calling them Russian spies and using as a main, at least a main part of the probable cause for that FISA warrant, relying on the Chris Steele British spy dossier that he wrote as opposition research for Hillary Clinton, but not disclosing the specifics of that dossier. For instance, that it was opposition research paid for by the other campaign. And unfortunately, and probably I should say, I said this a long time ago, it seems doubtful that the FBI or any of the other intelligence agencies vetted that dossier very well. Maybe they confirmed one travel or something, but I don't think they actually did a very good job of investigating to see if it was true. And if they just presented that to the FISA judge and without really giving the context and pretending that, this is true. This is the FBI. We're giving it to you as from the FBI. That is probably what Lindsey Graham and some of the others were saying really shocked them. You go back to your ordinary person who probably doesn't understand much of this process, and maybe it won't be very shocking to, especially to Democrats right now who have this partisan partisan thinking in their head where they don't care about this kind of thing. And it is kind of complicated. But I think that's what most of this four-page Nunes memo involves, the seeking of the FISA warrant and its reliance on that specious dossier constructed for opposition research.
Colleen, you and I were talking offline before we started the show about the fact that it seems to be human nature to want to choose a side. But it is certainly possible here, isn't it, to not like Donald Trump and not want to support Donald Trump, but at the same time to understand that something is rotten at the highest levels of the FBI. I think you've come to really the crux of the issue, and you are discussing exactly what the New York Times was discussing two or three days ago, saying that the issue now may be filtering down to people like Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, and Carter Page, who apparently is being accused of being a Russian agent. But at the same time, the FBI lied to the FISA court judge about the source of the information in the first place, that it was opposition research from the Clinton campaign. It was not a clandestine source or law enforcement source that was reporting to them. So what happens next? What happens when this memo is released, the information is available to the American public, and then the Democrats attack it? Then what happens?
Okay, let me back up here. I agree with you. The partisanship is really part of the problem. It's really quite more than possible, but many of us can criticize all the parties involved. And in fact, Hillary Clinton and Trump were both under investigation, or their campaigns were under investigation in the weeks before this 2016 presidential election. That is unprecedented. That's an unprecedented situation. I see almost nobody. You know why? Nobody mentions how unprecedented it was to have both campaigns under investigation by the highest level law enforcement agency in the country. I mean, talk about embarrassing from an international standpoint. But you know why no one mentions that? Because of the partisanship. They take sides immediately, and they don't even see the overall picture. The overall picture now is that not only are all of these private figures in the campaigns under investigation, but also now the FBI figures or officials are themselves, and DOJ officials are themselves, falling under investigation. That makes it even more unprecedented. It's like touching this, it's like touching it with your pole made you dirty yourself. I mean, you don't even want to touch something like this because of how dangerous it is. I criticized Mueller and especially the selection of Mueller for his having conflicts of interest with key people, key figures, Comey especially. They're joined at the hip. And the fact that Mueller had himself engaged in all of these terrible sordid background things, including overlooking torture, by the way. Mueller, made the agents, you're supposed to report torture if you know what's going on. And he told the agents to keep quiet about it, but just walk away. So, you know, people that put him on a pedestal now are completely wrong. He covered up the highest crimes. I criticized his selection because I said, you know, Comey, Rosenstein, and Mueller are essentially the leading members of the Mutual Admiration Society. We have 1.3 million attorneys in the United States, and you have to pick the one attorney who goes back 20 years with the key figures that you're supposed to be investigating and who has a personal dog in the fight. That is incredible, but it's just a symptom. With all of that said, I'm going to answer the last part of your question, which is, what do I think is going to happen? And I've been reading a lot about this. I think this is at least a educated guess, but I don't think Mueller will indict Trump for the reason that there's really a strong policy and dislike of going after the sovereign. You know, Nixon wasn't completely wrong when he says, you know, if the president does it, it's not illegal. The king can do no wrong, which goes back forever, is still ingrained in our president. So now if a president murdered his wife in the White House, I think that strong opinion policy that you can't indict a president, and a current president at least, I think that would fall away if you had a real solid crime. The situation that Mueller's investigating, which now looks like it's leaning only towards obstruction, trying to put together an obstruction case without a real crime. If you go back to Watergate, at least in Watergate, you could say how much evidence they had on Trump himself for obstructing and covering up the plumbers and his men that were working for him. You can question all of that. But what you couldn't question in Watergate is there was a crime of a break-in. And that was a real solid part of it. What you have now with the Russia collusion is nothing. You have smoke and mirrors. They have never been able to prove the Russia collusion itself. And so the obstruction that comes about as Trump fires Comey and et cetera, is really based on, you know, what I don't know how to explain this, but, you know, it's not on solid ground in a way, the way that the Nixon one was, because at least there was a solid crime to begin with. So that what you're left with, if Mueller does not indict, which I'm thinking he won't, I think that he'll produce a report and may well be a damning report. And then that will leave it up to Congress as to whether to launch impeachment or not.
Colleen Raleigh, let's look at this from, again, we're trying to help the broad audience here sort of discern what's going on and go through some of the basic facts. And to do that, what's important is the timeline. Here you have the FBI going to the FISA court and telling the FISA court, apparently, and we think this is what's in the memo, that Carter Page should be surveilled. And he is a member of the Trump team. And the basis that they're telling the FISA judge for that is that he's a Russian agent. But that assertion comes from the Steele dossier. Steele is a former British intelligence agent who collected data on behalf of Trump's Republican rivals. And then Hillary Clinton picked him up after Trump, won the nomination for the Republican Party. That's part of the story. Let's go back now to Andrew McCabe and what's going on there, because here we have this week Andrew McCabe announcing that he was resigning. He did resign. He was going to resign anyway. But let's go again through the audience for the audience and look at some of these details. Back on July 5th, 2016, James Comey had a press conference, and he said at that time, although, quote, the FBI did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. So Comey is rebuking Clinton, but saying it's not gross negligence, it's not criminal negligence, it's extremely careless. Those are very carefully chosen words. Now, in September 2016, Huma Abedin and her husband, Anthony Weiner's apartment was raided by the FBI. And during that raid, they took the computers, Huma Abedin, and she's a principal, maybe the most important advisor to Hillary Clinton. They took her computer and they discovered on the computer that there were thousands of pages of other State Department related emails. In other words, the investigation that Comey said was over on July 5th, 2016, was in essence reopened based on the gleaning of more information, thousands of documents from Huma Abedin's computer. Now, that's in September, late September, early October 2016, about 6 weeks before the election. On October 23rd, just about 3 weeks later, the Wall Street Journal reported that Andrew McCabe's wife, Jill, received nearly $500,000 from Clinton ally and then Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe for her unsuccessful run for the state assembly in Virginia. How can you have $500,000 and lose? I don't know about that part. But
and in a local race, it's crazy to spend that kind of money.
Now, we find out then, or we start to find out, we, the public, start to find out also that Andrew McCabe, her husband, and she's the one who just got $500,000 from McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, ally of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, longtime allies, that Andrew McCabe was the one in charge of looking at the additional emails that were ascertained from Huma Abedin's computer in late September, early October. And nobody said anything about them because Andrew McCabe, according to what Trump is asserting and what the Republicans are asserting, that Andrew McCabe was slow rolling the investigation until after the election, which everybody expected Hillary Clinton would win. And then it would be like, okay, there's these thousands of documents, more documents, Hillary Clinton's emails from the State Department on a private email email and email server, but it doesn't matter because now she's president of the United States. But James Comey is looking at all of this and realizing, this is what I think, realizing after the Wall Street Journal reported this new revelation about Andrew McCabe's wife, and that Andrew McCabe was the one overseeing the email investigation, that it would appear, it would give the appearance of impropriety on the part of the FBI if they held back from releasing those documents, those email, those Hillary Clinton emails until after the election. In other words, it would look like the election had been corrupted. So then James Comey sends a letter to Congress. I think that's October 28th, 11 days before the election, which he admits was an unusual thing right before the election, saying that they're reopening the investigation. This is 3 weeks after they've gotten these thousands of documents, but only days after the Wall Street Journal report about Andrew McCabe's wife. And then that became the news story. The mass media picked it up. It dominated the news. And Hillary Clinton says in her book, and the Democrats have been saying afterwards, the reason she lost narrowly in these battleground states was because of the shadow that overrode the campaign in its last 11 days as a consequence of Comey's a letter to Congress announcing the reopening of the investigation. But Comey may have felt he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't in terms of revealing at that time and after the Wall Street Journal report of October 23 about McCabe and his wife. If he doesn't reveal them, he looks like he's pulling the election towards Clinton. If he does reveal them, he's going to be pounced on by the Clinton campaign, but he's sort of caught between, you know, a rock and a hard place. Is that a possible scenario here, Colleen?
Yes, I think it's the correct. I think it's the correct interpretation. And in fact, if you remember, this is a while back. I actually said the exact same thing. I was one of the very few who defended Comey's publicly reopening the investigation of Hillary Clinton after finding those additional emails. Most people, especially on the liberal Democrat side, were very critical and blaming Comey, and of course afterwards blaming Comey for Hillary's loss. And I was looking at it from the standpoint of being in the FBI and saying, well, you know, really, what could you do? You're between a rock and a hard place. You have to walk a tightrope here and try to do your best. And I was actually defending Comey's. So I've been in that same interpretation since day one. The thing I didn't know was that perhaps McCabe did know about these emails sooner and did not let Comey know. It's a good thing that the inspector general, obviously with all of this, and you haven't even mentioned all of the details and all of the allegations about McCabe. There's actually a few more out there too. But with all of these allegations swirling about McCabe and the fact that his wife got this huge amount of money from Hillary Clinton's camp, it is certainly correct and good that the Inspector General, Department of Justice Inspector General, is investigating this. Like I said, now you even have the FBI officials under the investigation themselves. But it's a good thing he's doing that. I kind of doubt. Again, I'm a kind of a cynic, and I'm kind of a suspicious. And not suspicious, but I guess just pessimistic that the inspector general will actually be able to find out too much about McCabe. And the reason is in this particular circumstance, McCabe has a lot of excuses. He can say, well, you know, I didn't take it that seriously. You know, he can say it's his intent. And so you would have to know what was going on in his mind. Was he really trying to delay this, or was it just a lot of other reasons? And he could have all other kinds of innocent reasons for having delayed the investigation of these additional emails of Huma Abedin. So I don't think that it will really come up with much unless there are more things. And the one other thing that I've heard about, whether it's true or not, is that McCabe may have insisted on some word changes in some of the witness interviews. The FBI leaves itself open. We don't have enough time to discuss it, but because they don't tape record their witness interviews, they leave themselves open to the controversy that the agent did not transcribe exactly what the person said. So if McCabe did suggest a change of wording, that will be another, it'll be just another little piece in here. And then, of course, as you mentioned, did McCabe have a role in authorizing, signing off on the FISA memo application that was misleading? Did he have a role? Rosenstein apparently had a role. What I've been hearing from these national law newsletters I see is that people are already speculating on a replacement for Rod Rosenstein. And there's 1.3 million attorneys in the country that are not part of the Comey, Mueller, Rosenstein Mutual Admiration Society that they could have picked for some of these delicate independent investigations. And so why they all these friends are investigating each other is beyond me.
John Kiriakou, you know, the standard here is not simply about corruption or wrongdoing. It's also about the appearance, because the appearance is there's a reason that that's the gold standard, because you have to give clear indication to the public and to all that politics is not driving what's going on, or corruption is not driving. It's the appearance of corruption.
Yes.
Now, if you have Andrew McCabe's wife, who we did not know, and again, you know, and everybody who listens to this show know, I'm a fierce opponent of Donald Trump. But let's be independent here. If Andrew McCabe is overseeing the Clinton email investigation, and I believe the Inspector General of the FBI or the Department of Justice already was investigating whether that investigation of the Clinton Foundation, which began in 2015, which was being led by McCabe, was being slow rolled. In other words, not trying to have it come to a conclusion before the 2016 presidential election. And we find out at the last minute that he's the one overseeing the newly released documents from Huma Abedin's computer, hundreds of thousands of pages in late September, early October, right before the election. And then weeks later, we find out that his wife received almost $500,000 from a chief Clinton aide, ally, Terry McAuliffe. It gives the appearance of impropriety. It gives the appearance of corruption. And that's really, for all the Trump supporters who are saying this was a setup, that's grist in the mill. I mean, and certainly this is going to come out. And if the same person, Andrew McCabe, who's being cheered on by CNN as a great, you know, sort of champion or defender of freedom and democracy, if he had a role in getting a FISA warrant based on opposition research, again, paid for by the same Clinton family, that just gives the appearance of impropriety.
Yeah, it's just simply wrong. You and Colleen are both correct. And I'm going to add something to that. The American people own this information, right? The American people have a right to see this information. The Wall Street Journal, and believe me, I rarely agree with the Wall Street Journal editorial page, but the Wall Street Journal says today that Americans deserve to know what the FBI was doing. The FBI, it says, might well have had cause to believe, for example, that Russians were targeting the Trump campaign when they sought a foreign intelligence surveillance court warrant. But Washington also should be able to investigate if and how law enforcement agencies exceeded their remit in seeking wiretaps. Now, if the FBI and the Deputy Attorney General went to the FISA court judge with Democratic opposition research and either lied about the source or neglected to tell the judge what the source of the information was, that does indeed smell of corruption.
And Colleen, we have just a little bit more than 2 minutes. It also says a lot about the dangers of a FISA court. I don't even think it should be called a court.
I agree.
Because they just accept whatever the FBI tells them. There's no real adversarial proceedings there. Nobody's to say, show me the evidence. They just have to believe the FBI or the intelligence agencies. And whoever that judge is doesn't want to be held responsible for some terrorist threat or so. In other words, the FISA court is really a fig leaf, it seems to me. Anyway, Colleen, less than 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's true. It's secrecy itself. I always quote a famous, I think it's Edmund Burke, but He says everything secret degenerates, even the administration of justice. It's the secrecy itself that's the problem. One of the reasons for the American people to know these facts and this truth, which of course is going to make Watergate is already, I think, pale in comparison to this mess that's going on. But one of the real valid reasons is for the American public then to pressure Congress to pass some laws or rectify this problem. It's certainly the appearance of corruption, if nothing else. An easy fix is to restore the Hatch Act in its strictest form, which, by the way, was something I worked in the FBI under the strict form of the Hatch Act, and it just got loosened to things that allow, for instance, McCabe's wife to get this money and all these things. The Department of Justice is even looser than the FBI, and I think we should go back to having a strict form of the Hatch Act so these political activities are not allowed by public servants in the executive branch, because you just see all the problems it's led to.
All right. I think we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We want to thank Colleen Rowley for joining us. She is a former FBI special agent. In 2002, Colleen was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be back with the top stories of the day. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.